The education of children has been made to seem so technical an undertaking in our century, so innately a matter for certified experts, that only the credentialed appear worthy of a place in the forum of public debate. Most of us agree to that questionable premise by default. We abandon the field when the subject comes up. Yet that very Egyptian idea, the perfect subordination of the laity to the leadership, would have disgusted the founders of colonial New England to the core. The congregational idea that animated early Massachusetts was a very different one, a potent antidote to the idea that human society is best arranged as a pyramid. This contrary idea that spread for a time wherever citizens of New England roamed came originally from church life, but the habits it encouraged were not exclusively theological. They generalized to every aspect of daily life, teaching that within broad limits, every human being is sovereign, not as an ideal, but as a practical reality. The corrosion of regard for authority and the symbols of authority worked so powerfully in the century and a half after the pilgrims landed that out of the relatively benign authority of 18th century England, this country revolted and a mighty new nation was launched. At the end of the 20th century in America, what we all seem to be looking for in schooling is a mighty new idea. In the belief that the congregational idea is not a historical curiosity, but a prescription for a sane democratic society, I offer this argument that follows as part of the solution to our school nightmare. The organization of the first Puritan church at Salem in 1629 by the Salem Procedure, as it was called, was an act of great historical importance. No higher-ups were around to approve the selection of church authorities, so the congregation took that responsibility upon itself. That simple act took power that had traditionally belonged to some certified expert and placed it in the hands of people who went to church. That was the sole criteria of governance, that a voter took going to church seriously and joined a congregation as evidence. It was an act of monumental localism. For the next 200 years, that simple shedding of traditional authority broke the monopoly power of the state to broadcast uniform versions of the truth. Each separate congregation took a vigorous role in particularizing its own parish, through debate of lay members, not through the centralization inherent by pronouncements from some outside authority. Today, in the face of the moral and intellectual collapse of public education, which troubles so many people, and the even more mystifying inability of government monopoly schools to train people successfully to add and subtract, or do the hundred simple tasks necessary to maintain an independent life, we are asked to patiently try once again a variety of expert solutions suggested by the very players who profit most from uniform schooling. Some want a national curriculum, some a longer school year, some want children confined earlier than age 5, earlier than age 4 even. Others want to tie jobs and promotions to school grades as a motivation that kids should shape up. The experts who recommend these things come from teacher colleges, from business boardrooms, from school board associations, from teacher unions, from national associations of political parents, and national associations in general. All are united in the sense they want their reforms used comprehensively, systematically, universally. To make a theological comparison, you might think of the Pope, or you might think of the Metropolitan Synods of Anglicanism, but you could never associate expert pronouncements of this stripe with New England congregationalism. That was inherently local, and it attached itself to particular men and women in particular families, not to humanity in general. If a congregation had a school problem, it would not welcome expert outside intervention. Instead, it would insist on its God-given right to do things its own way, to make its own mistakes. Naturally, we are far away from a time when we trusted each other like that. Since the Civil War, a century and a half of increasing expert intervention in our schools has left us believing there is no other way to get things done. We must give our lives over to certified experts. If you treat school questions as a priority, as I must after 26 years of trying, then you might join me in thinking we are wasting a peculiar national genius deeply embedded in our colonial beginnings when expertise was lampooned mercilessly with the same sharp tools used to undress other forms of aristocracy. The leveling of experts and laymen in the early United States had something of a kinship with the powerful vision of the Anabaptists, but in its exuberance, it drew more from the well of common sense humanity than from any spiritual doctrine. Something there was in all those small farmers and craftsmen and teamsters and proprietors in the colonial economy that had a deep, intuitive understanding of the fakery implicit in expert claims to superior wisdom. How often through human history such claims have been protection for economic privilege. No medical establishment such as we have today would have been allowed to exist in those days, let alone a monolithic government school establishment. Both were something the Tudor kings would have backed, but never the people of New England. That kind of conformist nonsense was what they had run away from. In light of the failure of American monopoly schooling to check our headlong rush into narcotic dreams, despair, and moral chaos, it is not unrealistic to ask that we mute the expert voice for a while and allow the individual, the family, the neighborhood, or any small group who wants to show what it can do. A million family schools over the past decade have demonstrated that uncertified parents, without the benefit of teacher college credentials, can pin back the ears of the best factory schools, public or private. These are surrealistic times. That's you I'm talking about.
We know.
These are surrealistic times. While the school horror rages unchecked from coast to coast, the scientific school establishment continues to float plans for further centralization in the form of national standards and national curriculum and improved national standardized testing. Magical promises are everywhere. Machines are the answer. Massive interventions are the answer. New forms of daycare are the answer. Baseball bats, bullhorns, and padlocks are the answer. In the face of a century and a half of searching, unsuccessfully for it, nobody seems to doubt for a minute that there is one answer, the one right answer. Perhaps you agree, perhaps not. That was written for other audiences. But if some lingering doubt exists in your mind about the possibility of a central prescription ever touching the school disease, then come back with me for a while to colonial New England, where a different theory of institutions existed, a theory that might lead to the best kind of rethinking, reform where serious mistakes are self-limiting and quickly foreclosed by natural market mechanisms. Come with me to the coast of colonial New England, to towns like Salem and Marblehead, Framingham and Dedham, Wellfleet and Provincetown. Consider a different perspective there that grew once out of the soil of a new world, a perspective that shocked the other nations with the productivity of its genius. Last fall, I spoke in the town of Dedham at a church built in 1638, only 9 years after the Arbella brought the nonconformists to Boston. The church I spoke in was a Unitarian Universalist parish, but it had originally been a congregational one. White spire, strikingly plain, graceful lines, the simplicity and rightness of congregational church architecture is absolutely unmistakable, isn't it? Now, you may or may not be aware that this style of worship was the original and exclusive religion of Massachusetts from the Salem Procedure until 1834, over 200 years of what seems to be a one right way religion. You were either a Congregationalist or you weren't anything you dared speak of in public. So far, that sounds like the school monopoly that ruined us, doesn't it? But you'll see the difference in a minute. These Congregationalists were so jealously protective of their monopoly that 170 years ago, when famous Lyman Beecher got word that the Unitarians were on their way from the bowels of hell to Boston, he rode through the streets, just like Paul Revere, shouting, "The Unitarians are coming! The Unitarians are coming!" You'll gather Parson Beecher wasn't exactly thrilled with their advent, but an amazing thing happened over the next century. Beecher's party slowly changed its mind without being forced to do it. By the end of the 1800s, Unitarians were well respected everywhere in Massachusetts. Most people think of colonial New England as a benchmark for the greatest period of conformity this country ever saw. Part of that mistaken habit of thought stems from the fact that everyone was congregational or nothing at all. But the nature of Congregationalism hides a very great irony. Structurally, this religion demands that you be individual, not regimented. The service is almost free of liturgy, emphasizing local preaching about local issues. This virtually guarantees dissonance inside the congregation because different people have different points of view on local issues. The constant struggle for light by every church member acting as his own priest, his own best expert, invariably leads to progress toward truth. Why do I say that? Well, what I've just described to you is the process that Aristotle or Karl Marx or Thomas Hobbes or any number of heavy-thinking college professors would call the dialectic. The congregational procedure was dialectical right down to its roots in a way that Egyptian hierarchical thought can never understand. At bottom, congregational thought is Greek to its core and the secret of understanding the classical Greek way. Central planners in any period despise the dialectic because it gets in the way of efficiently broadcasting one right way to do things. Half a century ago, Bertrand Russell, the great mathematician, remarked that the United States was the only major country on earth that deliberately avoided teaching its children to think dialectically. He was talking about 20th century America, of course, the land of compulsory government schooling, not the New England of congregational distinction. Did you wonder where our Yankees got their lasting reputation for stubbornness, orneriness, and shrewd hair splitting? Now you know. Roger Williams, who founded Rhode Island, saw as clearly as any man of his times and recognized the inevitable connection between dissonance and human quality. You can't have one without the other. You have to have people with different ways arguing and discussing and talking and negotiating with each other. Whatever else God is, he must have a sense of humor to arrange things so. Much recent scholarship has shown the towns of Massachusetts in the 17th century not to be uniform at all, but to be laboratories of local choice and local style, like homeschoolers or such laboratories today. Each had considerable flexibility to deviate from the central government way. The town of Dedham, where I spoke last fall, drew its original settlers from East Anglia back in England, a place that favored private ownership and individual choice. The institutions of Dedham quickly established this style as their pattern in the New World, too. Sudbury, on the other hand, which is the town right next to Dedham, had been populated by colonists of Saxon and Celtic background, these people traditionally shared work in common. Just as they had done in Britain, they held open fields in common in America. In colonial Massachusetts then, there was creative tension between the common culture of the region and the local village culture, like tension in music or tension in poetry between a regular pattern and creative departures from it. This tension among the small towns and among the different congregations and inside each separate congregation produced an astonishing energy, a fertile and idiosyncratic peculiarity that pushed Massachusetts to the forefront in every endeavor that it took. Now I want us to look at something that seems embarrassing in New England civic life, and probably is, yet paradoxically I think it hides a secret of great power which the social engineers who built and maintain our government monopoly schools are forced to overlook. Each town in Massachusetts in colonial times was able to exclude people it didn't like. People were able to choose who they wanted to work with, to sort themselves into a living curriculum that worked for them. The words of the first Dedham Town Charter catch this feeling perfectly. The original settlers wanted to shut out and did, and now I'm quoting from the Dedham Town Charter from 1637, people such as whose dispositions do not suit us, whose society will be hurtful to us. So in a funny way, these early towns functioned like selective clubs or colleges like MIT and Harvard do today. They narrowed human differences down to a range that could be managed by them humanely. If you consider the tremendous stresses that the dialectical process sets up anyway, where no one has to accept given truth, but everyone's entitled to argue with truth. So there's a lot of emotional stress when you accept that as a rule you'll live by. It's hard to see how a congregational society can do otherwise than to narrow the range of people it works with. If you have to accept everybody, no matter how hostile they may be to your own personality, philosophy, or mission, then an operation must quickly become paralyzed by fatal disagreements. The common causes and purposes that mark human association at its best must degrade into innocuous undertakings that won't rile anybody or get their back up, that have no political dimension. It's a subtle distinction. Living dialectically as the New Englanders did produces spectacular accomplishments and brings out strong qualities of character and mind in individuals, but it isn't possible to manage where the whole catalog of human beings is thrown together or forced together as it is in government monopoly school life. To prevent anarchy in such places, the management must aim by hook or by crook to make everything, time, space, texts, and procedures as uniform as possible. Now the Greeks had a story about a man who did that. His name was Procrustes. He cut or stretched travelers to fit his guest bed. The system worked perfectly, but it played havoc with the traveler. So these New Englanders invented a system where people who wanted to hang out together could do that. Yet the whole region seemed to prosper in wonderful ways, materially as such things are measured, intellectually and socially. It was almost as if by taking care of your own business, you succeeded in some magical fashion in taking care of public business too. The habits of self-reliance, self-respect, fearlessness, democracy, and local loyalty produced good citizens. Government monopoly schools use a different blueprint these days. People are drawn willy-nilly out of large catchment areas, as they're called, and dumped into compartments together according to similar scores on standardized tests. There they are exhorted to perform and behave according to the specification of strangers. Christopher Lash, who I think is one of the major American thinkers writing today, he's a history professor at the University of Rochester. He has a book out now called The True and Only Heaven about this one right way thinking that came to dominate the United States after the Civil War. He says in The True and Only Heaven, I quote, "The capacity for loyalty is stretched too thin when it attaches itself to hypothetical solidarity of the whole human race. It needs to attach itself to specific people and places, not to an abstract ideal of universal human rights. We love particular men and particular women, not humanity in general," which catches a piece of what's wrong with compulsory schools that are as large as the New England towns were. The schools in the town where I teach are 4,000 or 5,000 or 6,000 kids and hundreds of teachers and administrators. These places allow neither choice of curriculum, choice of philosophy, or choice of companions. Local skills, local knowledge, local love, and local fidelity were what the forge of congregationalism in New England produced best. But there was a bad side to this localism, too. The religious discrimination of early New England was a way of ensuring enough local harmony that a community of people who suited each other could arise bearing a common vision. Here is a scene from 300 years ago in the town of Dedham, Massachusetts, that isn't very pretty, and it could have been witnessed from the steps of the church that I spoke in there. Three Quaker women were stripped to the waist and whipped the length of the town, tied to the tail of a cart. That was by way of underlining that the Quaker disposition was not one suited to the town of Dedham. But then, for that matter, neither was the Presbyterian disposition. John Milton himself had written that new presbyter is but old priest writ large. The gripe was that the Presbyterians meet once a year, and the Congregationalists said that even if there are 10 congregational churches in 100 acres, they don't talk to each other, they don't care what each other does. They're intensely local. So the Presbyterians all rode off to the state of New Jersey and founded Princeton. Of course, it was bad for your health to be a Catholic in Dedham, or to be a leveler, a digger, or a Hooterite. In this detestable fashion, Dedham was able for 234 years to enjoy religious purity before its congregational monopoly was broken. Well, what does this all mean? What am I driving at? Just this: the bad side of local choice is very easy to see, and it's even very easy to predict. We see it illustrated in the example of colonial Dedham. But the whole matter is a good deal more complicated than assigning a bad grade to religious discrimination or to any other type of social choice that describes a particular kind of human association. For instance, where could we begin to look for an explanation of how these people in Dedham gradually grew more tolerant and came to accept all forms of religion? No one forced them to do that. There weren't any laws or injunctions. They were the boss. They even changed their conservative ways to a point where Massachusetts has gained a national reputation as the most liberal state in the Union. That's quite a flip-flop to account for in the absence of compulsion, intimidation, or enabling legislation, isn't it? How did Dedham and the rest of those towns teach themselves to reform without experts making them do it, and without plenty of central intervention? Remember, they only allowed the practitioners of one religion to vote, but they changed, and nobody forced them to do it. Something mysterious inside the structure of Congregationalism worked to have them abandon some of the exclusivity that Old Testament elite dogma had taught them. I am certain that something was unconditional local choice. It was self-correcting, because churches then didn't team up to present an institutional orthodoxy so that one town was just exactly like another town, as government monopoly schools do today. Error in one church could be counteracted by its correction in another. As long as people had the choice to vote with their feet, the free market punished severe errors by leaving a congregation empty, just as it could reward a good place by filling it up. And even if enough rotten people were found to make a rotten town or a rotten congregation, as long as there was no machinery in place for that one idea to compel all the others to bow down before it, the human damage it could cause was strictly limited. Only when tools exist out of which a central orthodoxy can rise, like an Egyptian pyramid, is there a real danger that some central poison will poison us all. Yes, the bad side of local choice is easy to spot, but the overwhelming argument in its favor that without it, the genius of democracy cannot exist is hard to see. The temptation is strong to cede power to a central authority in the name of fairness, to manage some best way for all from central headquarters. That's what a national curriculum will be for our schools, a rational, fair way to legislate bad schooling out of existence. A national curriculum would never have allowed Dedham or Sudbury or Framingham or Wellfleet to develop as different types of town. That would have been dangerous, unpredictable, divisive. No, they would have regulated centrally, as our schools are today, even without a national curriculum and national standards. And here comes the dialectic. The experience of our centrally planned century has not been a very good one. According to some authorities, the planet itself is in substantial jeopardy. And things legislated out of existence don't seem to go away, as religious exclusivity did go away naturally in New England under a regime of local choice. Instead, law appears to give bad habits an injection of virulent new life. Does central legal intimidation produce the social results it promises? Not so long ago, just before the First World War, narcotics were legal in the United States. And while they were always a pernicious nuisance, they never became an epidemic before legislation prohibiting their use came into existence. Is it possible that compelling people to do something guarantees they will do it poorly, do it with a bad will, do it indifferently, or not do it at all? Unless you're willing, as the Army is, to suspend human rights and use any degree of intimidation necessary to make everybody shine their shoes the same way. And if the latter is the only way that compulsion can produce results, what on earth is the human value of using it, since it so diminishes the quality of human life? Multiple prohibitions of choice in the matter of education are now enforced by law, enshrining an exclusive bureaucracy of certified teachers and certified administrators and literally hundreds of invisible agencies necessary to maintain the institution of government monopoly schooling. Defying the lessons of the market, this psychopathic megalith has grown more and more powerful in spite of all the colossal failures to educate that we're well aware of. It succeeds in surviving because it employs the police power of the state to fill its hollow classrooms. It prohibits local choice. It prohibits local variety. And because of this prohibition, it has a hideous Egyptian effect on our national moral fabric. Our experience with the national prohibition of alcohol by legislation, our experience on what it did to our social cohesion and common values as a nation, is an object lesson too recent to forget, I hope. And compared to the prohibitions that government monopoly schooling imposes on the children and families of a nation, alcohol prohibition was hardly a blip on the screen. By preventing a free market in education, a handful of social engineers, soon backed by the industries that profit from compulsion schooling, teacher colleges, textbook publishers, material suppliers. I don't think many people are aware how many industries desperately have to hold on to cramming 6,000 kids into a building so that they don't have to come around door to door and say, excuse me, would you like to buy my book? They can say, hey, here's 6,000 at a pop. Or in Texas and Oklahoma, I understand it's 100,000 at a pop. And in California, it's several million at a pop. By preventing a free market in education, these social engineers have ensured that most of our children will not get an education, even though they may very well be thoroughly schooled. Some of us are old enough to remember what happened when the Soviet Union legislated the market system out of existence. Divorced from religion, the congregational principle is a psychological force propelling almost everybody to reach his maximum individual potential in small groups of people with whom he feels in harmony. If you think about this, you wonder what purpose is achieved by arranging things in any other way. The Congregationalists knew that good things happen to the human spirit when it is left alone. No two Congregational churches ever got together. They didn't compare notes. They didn't inquire after each other's doctrine. They had no large meetings like the Presbyterians did. I hit the Presbyterians so hard because my wife's a Presbyterian. No universal newsletters. Local choice produced the confidence, singularity, and resourcefulness of early New England, and what miracles those people accomplished. New England ships were selling ice cut from New England ponds to India, of all places, long before you could take a train from Boston to Chicago. They were sawing the ice out of their ponds and selling it halfway across the world. I think it takes a lot of confidence, or what my Jewish friends would call chutzpah, to do that, but they got away with it. New England ships were seen in every port across the planet long before the Massachusetts legislature passed the world's first compulsory schooling law. Indeed, according to Senator Kennedy's office, he's a Massachusetts senator, 98% of Massachusetts could read, write, and do arithmetic well before compulsory schooling came along. The numbers are not so good in Massachusetts today. The forms, the spirit, the leadership of New England from its congregational period shaped every American institution, and all that came without formal schooling by government monopoly fiat. Now, the best immediate evidence I have to offer that leaving people alone to work out their own local destinies is a splendid idea is the curious sociology of my presence as a speaker in Dedham, Massachusetts last year. There in a community that had whipped half-naked Quaker women, stood I, a Roman Catholic, with a Scots Presbyterian wife, accompanied by my good friend Roland, who was a former student of mine, who's half pagan and half Jewish, in a Unitarian church that had once been a Congregational church. No act of the Massachusetts legislature made that possible. No pronouncement of the Supreme Court. People learned to be neighbors in Dedham because they were allowed real choice for 300 years, including the choice to make their own mistakes. Everyone learned a better way to deal with difference than exclusion because they had time to think about it. Time measured in generations, not in a few years or a few decades. But if they had been ordered to change, ordered as our immigrants were, to change their behavior and abandon their culture in compulsory schools set up for that very purpose, I think that what would have happened is this. Some of them would have seemed to change, but would have harbored such powerful resentments at being deprived of their choice that some way to exact vengeance would have evolved. And most of the group, deprived of choice and custom and family and roots, would have gone quietly insane, becoming simplified people, fit to haul stones to build pyramids, possibly, or to watch television produce its simplified fantasies, but fit for little else. As Marshall said earlier, John Dewey said, we have to dumb the masses down. Despite the lip service we continue to pay to local choice ever since congregational days, our schools are centrally planned and do indeed have a national curriculum already in place. They have failed so spectacularly to give us the children we want, or the selves we want, or the dream of a democratic, classless society we all still yearn for, that the logic of our failure is hard to miss. By imposing directions from a godlike control center, we have time and again missed the lesson of the congregational principle, that people are less than people unless they gather themselves into groups of souls in harmony. Only slaves are gathered by others. and gather themselves for what? To pursue individual, family, and community dreams consistent with their own private humanity. These dreams must be written locally, because to exercise any larger ambition is to lose touch with the only things that give life meaning. Self, family, friends, work, and intimate community. Anything else is an Egyptian illusion of American life, and American life is not Egyptian, no matter what the back of our dollar tells us about a new world order built to look like a pyramid. The way of the West, your West, has always tended to be about individuals, families, neighborhoods, and congregations. Herd behavior makes us sick. It has made our schools sick, sick places to send children to learn up to be good Americans in. I am struck by the similarity of the congregational way of life to the organization of North American Indian life, intensely local and obedient to the genius of the place, so that the cousinage of all Indian tribes is apparent, yet the way of each tribe is its own. There seem to me two official ways to look at the state of education in the U.S., both of them wrong. First, we conceive it to be an engineering problem that can be made to yield to a pragmatic engineering instrumental approach. From this vantage point, there is a simple right and wrong about the school thing, never the 1,000 private rights that New England Congregationalists believed there were. The second wrong way we look upon schooling is as if it were a character in a continuous courtroom drama, a drama wherein we search for the villains who have prevented our kids from learning. Bad teachers, bad textbooks, bad administrators, bad politicians, bad parents, bad children. Whoever the villain may be, we shall find him, arraign him, indict him, prosecute him, execute him. Then things will be okay. Out of these two wrong ways have grown enormous industries which claim power to cure mass education of its frictions or of its demons in exchange for money. Into this carnival of magical thinking has come a parade of profit seekers, analysts, consultants, researchers, academic houses, writers, advisors, columnists, textbook committees, school boards, testing corporations, journalists, teacher colleges, state departments of education, monitors, coordinators, manufacturers, certified teachers and administrators, Sesame Streets, and hordes of school-related businesses, all parasitic growth on the government monopoly school concept, the bed of Procrustes school. You remember, he's the guy that if you're too long for his bed, cuts your feet off, and if you're too short, he stretches you. The greatest attraction of social engineering and antisocial demonologies to the common man is that both at bottom promise a quick fix. And I see that here I'm echoing something that Marshall said earlier today. That has always been the dark side of the American dream, the search for an easy way out, a belief in magic. The endless parade of magical promises that constitute the heart of American advertising testifies to the deep well of superstition in our national foundation, which has been institutionalized in the advertising business. Easy money, easy health, easy beauty, easy education, if only the right incantation could be found. Lurking behind the magic is an image of people as machinery that can be built and repaired. This is our Calvinist legacy calling to us over the centuries, saying the world and all its living variety, all its beautiful variety, is just machinery, not very hard to adjust. If we put sentimentality aside and fire the villains, either symbolically today or in those days with actual bonfires, depending on the century, school reform to most of us is an engineer reaching for the right wrench or Perry Mason finding the clue he needs to nail the bad guy. Ultimately, how we think about social problems depends on our philosophy of human nature, what we think people are, what we think people are capable of, what the purposes of human existence may be. If people are machines, then school can only be a way to make these machines more reliable. The logic of machine things dictates that parts be uniform and parts be interchangeable, that all operations be time-constrained, predictable, and economical. This machine idea has been around for thousands of years, but its effective reign has only been in the United States since the end of World War I. American education teaches by its methodology that man is a machine. Bells ring, circuits open and close, energy flows or is constricted, qualities are reduced to a numbering system, a plan is followed of which the machine parts know nothing. The old Congregationalists would have been able to put their finger at once on the reason pyramidal societies, such as the one our monopoly form of schooling sustains, must always end in disintegration. At the root, they are based on a lie that there is ever one right way in human affairs and that experts can be awarded the permanent direction of the enterprise of education. Monopoly schooling has been the chief training institution of the coming beehive society. It certifies permanent experts who enjoy privileges of status unwarranted by the results they produce. Because, because these privileges, once achieved, will not be willingly given up, whole apparatuses of privilege have been fashioned which are impregnable to change. Even under the severest criticism, they grow larger and more dangerous because they nourish important parts of our political and economic system. In the most literal sense, they are impossible to reform because they have ceased to be human. Having internalized into abstract structures, independent of human control, survival mechanisms of superb efficiency, this is not a devil you can wrestle with, as Daniel Webster did with Old Scratch, but one that has to be starved to death by depriving it of its victims while all of you are doing that. And I want to give you a... Time to stop. It doesn't work. Our world is coming apart. No amount of tinkering will make the school machine work to produce educated people. Education and schooling are mutually exclusive terms. Strangers. They can't stand in a family relationship with each other. And it has always been thus. In 1930, 60 long years ago, Thomas Briggs was delivering a very prestigious lecture at Harvard called the Inglis Lecture, that's given once a year to some major American scholar. And in his lecture at Harvard 60 years ago, he said, quote, "The nation's great investment in education has shown no respectable achievement." 2 decades later, in 1951, now we're going back 40 years, a survey made of 30,000 Los Angeles school children discovered that 75% of eighth graders could not find the Atlantic Ocean, and that 80% could not calculate one half of 36. What on earth is going on? Any genuine debate would have come to grips with the uniform failure of every type of government school since their inception. But since 1960, there has been a deadly difference in the effects of schooling. In combination with the universal spread of television, which was achieved in that year, by 1960, 94% of all American households had a television set. The destructive power of schooling with television is now awesome and thoroughly out of control. The television institution, structurally very similar as a teacher to the style of mass schooling, has expanded so successfully that most of the escape routes are now blocked. Kids could come home from school before 1960, and then they might cure themselves. But if you snap on the tube, it does its job the same way. It tells you what to watch. I don't believe there are good shows and bad shows. There are only shows that tells you what to watch, from what perspective to see it, and exactly how long to give it your attention. And then the next show in the sequence has nothing to do with the one that came before. No, television and schools are the same institution. We have destroyed the minds and characters of a nation's children by preempting their youth, deconstructing their families, trivializing their time, removing their choices. We will pay a hideous price in lost humanity for this crime for another century to come, even if a way is found to overturn the pyramid. But getting rid of the monopoly is the way to start the process working. What is there to do? Look to Dedham, to Sudbury, to Marblehead, to Provincetown, all different, yet all in harmony with each other and in harmony with themselves. Turn your back on national solutions and toward communities of families, the successful laboratories. Let them turn inward, cherish that until they master the first directive of Western philosophy, know thyself. Understand that successful communities today knew even back at the nation's beginning the truth of the words, good fences make good neighbors. The cities that failed, like New York, tried to homogenize their clientele, to make good Americans who looked, acted, smelled, and sang alike, who were taught the same synthetic dreams and the same sanitized fables. The cities that succeeded, like Pittsburgh, treasured their families and celebrated the differences sincerely. And the proof that Pittsburgh works is waiting there for you when you come to Pittsburgh. Look my mother up. She'll make you a cup of coffee. Look to the congregational principle for answers. Encourage and underwrite experimentation. Trust children. Trust families to know what is best for themselves. Stop the segregation of children and the aged in walled compounds called schools. Mix everyone back together again and involve everyone in the community in the education of the young. Look for local solutions and always accept a personal solution in place of a corporate one. Don't be panicked by scare tactics into surrendering your children to experts. I am the New York State Teacher of the Year, and everyone out there is a better teacher than I am, and I mean that sincerely. Teaching must, I think, be decertified as quickly as possible. That certified teaching experts, like myself, are necessary to make learning happen is a scam, a fraud. It's just not true. It's just another Egyptian illusion. Look around you. The results of teacher college licensing are everywhere. They're in the schools you see. Let anybody who wants to teach, who can attract an audience. And if they don't like what he's teaching, they can go elsewhere. Give families back their tax money to pick and choose. Who could possibly be a better shopper if the means for comparison were made available? Restore the 1,000-congregation system by encouraging competition after the free market model. Only in that way can the social dialectic come back to life. Trust in families, trust in neighborhoods, trust in individuals to make many senses of the important question, what is education for? If some of them answer for God, that's really not anyone's business but the speaker's. Our type of schooling has concealed deliberately that that question must be framed. It cannot be taken for granted if anything beyond a mockery of democracy is going to be nurtured. It is illegitimate to have an expert answer that question for you. That kind of trust once made us the watchword of the world back in early America. The momentum from the period of trust is the best thing about our country today, and it still reverberates around the planet. I feel certain its potency is still there waiting for us to use it, constituting an American solution to the great school nightmare. God bless you all. I have to catch a plane.